Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast presentation titled Paradigm Shift in Non-Motor Symptom Management in Parkinson's Disease. I'm Dr. Stuart Isaacson. I'm the director of the Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorder Center of Boca Raton in Boca Raton, Florida.
And I'm Rajesh Pawa. I'm a professor of neurology and director of the Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorder Center at the University of Kansas Medical Center in Kansas City, Kansas.
Today, we will focus on non-motor symptoms of Parkinson's disease. We'll discuss types of non-motor symptoms, their impact on patients' quality of life, and current and emerging treatment options for non-motor symptoms. Joining us in this conversation is Dr. Jennifer Goldman. Dr. Goldman is a movement disorders neurologist whose clinical and research work has focused on non-motor symptoms of Parkinson's. She is currently the secretary-elect for the International Parkinson's and Movement Disorders Society and an adjunct professor at Barrow Neurological Institute. Dr. Goldman previously was the section chief of Parkinson's disease and movement disorders at Shirley Ryan Ability Lab and professor at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago, Illinois. Thank you so much for joining us. Let's begin. Non-motor symptoms really have begun to define Parkinson's disease to a large extent. And while classically we thought about motor symptoms and the motor triad and motor fluctuations, and these are really important, non-motor symptoms are probably equally, in some instances, more important. What types of non-motor symptoms can we think about in Parkinson's disease?
Yeah, so, like you said, classically we think about motor symptoms, but the non-motor symptoms are also equally important. We can start all the way from neuropsychiatric issues such as psychosis, dementia, depression, anxiety, autonomic symptoms, orthostatic hypotension, bladder issues, constipation, drooling. I mean, we could just spend half an hour listing all the non-motor symptoms, but we can definitely go into them as we get further in our talk today.
Yeah, and it's interesting. A lot of these non-motor symptoms in the past we've thought about as being medication caused by medications and drug-induced. And we've really begun to understand, with synuclein degeneration being so widespread in Parkinson's disease, cortical, subcortical, brainstem nuclei, and peripherally in the autonomic and enteric nervous system, and that really is the basis for a lot of the non-motor symptoms. And it's really beyond dopamine. There's a lot of other neurochemicals involved.
Exactly.
Jennifer, you've thought a lot about non-motor symptoms. What's your view of when these non-motor symptoms begin? And when we're taking care of people with Parkinson's disease, do we have to think about them early on or later on? Or how do you think about these?
Sure, thank you. And I really think that we have begun to redefine Parkinson's to appreciate that it is not only a motor disease, but also a non-motor disease. And in fact, in many cases, those non-motor symptoms can occur years or decades before someone develops slowness or a tremor or changes in their walking. The non-motor symptoms can be present and pervasive throughout the whole course of Parkinson's, from the prodromal or premotor period to early diagnostic period, with presence of motor symptoms, to as the disease advances. But I think it's also important to think about that some of these non-motor symptoms will vary, and there may be different ones occurring early or different ones middle stage or later stage of the disease, and not everyone experiences the same non-motor symptoms or their same severity. So I'm sure we can go into detail into some of those more specifically as well.
Yeah, a lot of times when we see patients who have early motor symptoms of Parkinson's, we recognize some of these non-motor symptoms. How do they play a role in your diagnostic algorithm? Do you think it enhances the diagnostic accuracy early on if they have some of these non-motor symptoms that we've recognized to be prodromal?
So I think some of the non-motor symptoms that are most strongly associated with subsequent neurodegeneration or development of synucleinopathies include non-motor symptoms affecting sleep, like REM sleep behavior disorder, where people may act out their dreams when otherwise they shouldn't be moving about in their sleep. And so I think the presence of RBD is a strong harbinger and supportive of you know, the presence of neurodegeneration going along with the Parkinson's diagnosis or perhaps even other synucleinopathies. Some of the other non-motor symptoms can be rather non-specific. So things like constipation, depression, or anxiety, which can occur in many older individuals for numerous reasons. But I think their presence along with motor symptoms, or if they're present even before motor symptoms and we follow people over time, some percentage of those folks with these other symptoms like constipation or mood disorders will develop Parkinson's disease. And I think we always aspire that that is part of our holy grail of where we can have disease-modifying interventions. The other non-motor symptom that comes up often is reduced or loss of smell, which I think we're understanding even more about in relationship to presence of synuclein aggregates and changes in neurodegenerative pathways that, again, go back to that impending cascade of neurodegenerative events.
So Jennifer brought up the issue of REM sleep disorder. I think our sleep doctors are getting more and more aware that REM sleep disorder is a premotor symptom. I think that depression and anxiety is still a little challenging because often a patient who is depressed or anxious is seeing a psychiatrist, is put on psychiatric medications, and often they feel it is the medicine causing some of these symptoms rather than they're actually having the premotor symptoms. And I think that's another one where I think we need to be educating a little bit more that the psychiatrist should pay attention not only to the depression and anxiety, but also if these patients are developing a little bit of tremor or some other symptoms.
Yeah, one wonders, you know, we check a thyroid so commonly for a lot of non-specific symptoms. Do you think that in patients who have REM sleep behavior disorder, some depression and anxiety, who have a loss of smell, who have constipation, we'll be checking synuclein biomarkers, whether it's a skin biopsy or a seed assay in spinal fluid or blood in the near future? It's intriguing to think about these.
Yeah. I think we are rapidly getting to that point. I think it will become that we are going to be testing them. And what will happen, like Jennifer mentioned, is we will be having some of these biomarkers being positive before they actually even develop the motor symptoms. And we will have to then decide, hopefully by then we will have disease-modifying or slowing of the disease medications available, but what are we going to do at that stage? Hopefully we can one day have a talk here about how to prevent Parkinson's disease.
And, you know, as we enter this era of personalized medicine and precision medicine, we're looking at genes and abnormal genes, and it's interesting that some of these non-motor symptoms occur more commonly with certain genetic mutations than others, and it may open up a personalized approach to prevention and possibly a symptomatic treatment as well, and ultimately, hopefully, open the doors to precision medicine approach for our patients who are developing Parkinson's disease as we develop neuroprotective strategies. Definitely. Well, let's turn now to probably what our patients really want to know also is, how do you evaluate these non-motor symptoms? How do you find time and visits to ask about all these? How do you choose which ones to treat now and which ones to treat later? And do we need specific treatments for people with Parkinson's who have some of these non-motor symptoms? So let's start off with which of the non-motor symptoms are most important and which are most associated with impacting patients' daily life, quality of life in the short term and the long term. What do you think, Jennifer? Do you think some of these should be prioritized?
Yeah, well, you bring up a really great point that one of the first and, you know, most essential components is we need to be aware of the non-motor symptoms and we actually need to ask. So we need to think how we can make it normalized or part of a routine clinic visit that so often over the years has focused on testing for bradykinesia and rigidity and tremor and gait. We need to do those, but we also need to look at the non-motor symptoms. And some of that can be done through global screening scales and instruments that have been developed to be completed by the person with Parkinson's or their care partner or the clinician. There are a wide variety of tools out there. There's specific rating scales that people can use. And then there's, you know, old-fashioned conversation of asking people how they're doing and what sorts of symptoms are bothering them. But going back to which symptoms are most important to treat or most meaningful to treat, I think some of that question always depends on what's going on with a particular individual. So what might be bothersome to one person might not be bothersome to another. And sometimes we find, such as in the case of apathy, that's often more bothersome to the caregiver than to the person living with Parkinson's themselves. But with that said, I think, you know, there are a number of non-motor symptoms that can be associated with reduced quality of life and increased caregiver burden and stress. And some of those are the neuropsychiatric symptoms, including psychosis, you know, ranging from illusions to hallucinations to delusions, ones that affect cognition, including dementia, others that affect apathy or fatigue. But I think, you know, we don't want to neglect others that are also essential for the comprehensive treatment of Parkinson's, such as orthostatic hypotension and bladder function and pain. So I think there are a lot of potentially impactful and important symptoms that people can experience.
I mean, that's so true when we talk about, for each individual patient, what is their non-motor is more important than someone else's. You know, there are patients who may say, yeah, I have a little bit of constipation, but my biggest thing is I'm having sexual dysfunction. You know, that's what they feel is the one that needs to be important for them. But, you know, it is something that today, unless we even use simple screeners, just having the non-motor listed, having, are they present, not present, do they affect the patient, would make it so easy, because a patient while waiting for us could just circle the ones that are important and we could definitely discuss those. On the other hand, there are non-motor symptoms which we are still struggling to treat, like what she brought up, apathy, you know, that is so difficult to manage today.
Yeah, and it really brings up this idea. I think we were all surprised when we saw that one study that identified drooling as one of the leading symptoms, motor and non-motor, that patients found most bothersome. And I think this is something that really made me begin to think and understand better what we mean by shared clinical decision making. And Jennifer, how do you try to incorporate your patients' views, their caregivers and families, and what you know, and what our goals of trying to evaluate and treat our patients with what's important to our patients in a patient-centric model, but really using shared clinical decision-making, but making sure our patients are informed to share in that decision-making. It can be a struggle sometimes.
Yes, for sure. I think it's a complex and challenging situation, and particularly when, you know, there's so little time in a given appointment setting, and then, you know, there's big gaps of time in between different appointment clinic visits. So I do think there are a number of challenges or potential barriers. But in terms of, you know, addressing the symptoms in a clinical practice setting, so trying to understand what people's top priorities are at that visit or from the time between the visits, what I would see as a clinician, you know, sometimes we encounter that someone might not think there's an issue, but then you appreciate that maybe they're not so safe walking or have balance issues or something that we really need to intervene in a different way, or, you know, low blood pressure, orthostatic hypotension that could be dangerous for someone at from a fall risk perspective. And hearing from, you know, if they bring a care partner with them or have another person's input, and putting that all together, exploring those options, educating about what symptom treatments, medication-wise, non-medication-wise, are available, or research opportunities, and just trying to put that all together. I think we all appreciate too that in a clinic visit, often there can be multiple things to address. So it can be helpful to try to prioritize and say, what is the first thing we should work on right now? it doesn't mean we're not going to get to the others, but we would do this in a stepwise or staged approach.
Yeah, it can really be a challenge to decide what to treat today and how many things to treat at this visit over time. I like to think that, you know, we talk about motor symptoms. We often ask about how commonly it occurs, how severe it is, how much patients are aware of it. And you bring up the caregiver may notice tremor and not the patient or such, and the impact it has on daily activities. We don't always take that approach with non-motor symptoms. With non-motor symptoms, I think there's a temptation to just say, does it bother you? And we don't go into the frequency and the severity and the impact on daily life and the insight our patients have. And I like to think about constipation, for instance. A patient who says, oh, I have that, that's not bothering me. But then if you ask how many bowel movements a week do you have and they tell you two, we might be more concerned about that because there's a risk of impaction and medication and absorption and such.
So, Stu, one of the challenges we face in the clinic is we know certain of these non-motors are impacting their motor symptoms. You know, whether it is they are depressed and they are much more slower, their medicines are not working, they are constipated, they are having much more fluctuations. So, Jennifer, if you have a patient who is clearly depressed, so we screen them with geriatric depression scale, for example, we see they are really depressed. And, you know, the patient basically says, I don't want to add another medication. So on one side, you agree they're already on five medicines. Do you want to add the sixth one? But on the other hand, it is, you know, not only is going to help their non-motor symptom, but also the motor symptom. And if you try to talk to them, at least talking or seeing a psychologist, they feel that is not important too. How do you manage such a patient where you know they are going to benefit and the patient and maybe even the caregiver might be resistant to adding an antidepressant because of whatever their beliefs or concerns might be?
Well, that's a tricky scenario, but also a commonly experienced scenario that I bet all three of us could attest to. So, you know, on a clinical, practical or pragmatic level, one way is to look for medications. If someone's willing to add or try a new medicine that targets multiple areas, so something that might help with sleep and depression or anxiety, for example. I think, you know, the role of exercise and fluid intake, you know, are certainly important for constipation, but also important for other non-motor symptoms and quality of life. So there's a little bit of looking for that you know, two birds, one stone or win-win scenario, but there are also opportunities to reframe this or think about this, you know, just in a stepwise approach. So, you know, that is, can we try something and try it for a little bit and see how it goes, and if it is successful to continue on, or if it's not, to revisit the strategies. And there's opportunity for non-medication therapies that have to do with exercise or rehabilitation, lifestyle, nutrition aspects that I think can certainly impact and improve many aspects of quality of life and non-motor symptoms.
And I'm so glad you brought up this idea of these other non-pharmacological therapies, because I think in the past we've often thought about, you know, we try non-pharmacological and then we think about pharmacological and then we think about investigation on research medications. But I think in an integrated approach of trying to choose the best thing for our patient that day, we really want to integrate wellness strategies, FDA-approved medications, investigational medications, and choose the best strategy or combination of strategies for each individual patient, and not sort of segregate them. If you fail this, then move on to that. And I think thinking about it in this holistic way that you're bringing up can may really be a paradigm shift for our patients. If we can utilize wellness activities and approved therapies, investigational therapies in an integrated way, patients may benefit from it, because I think we're beginning to see Parkinson's as a widespread synuclein degeneration. But our patients are still maybe thinking a lot about the motor symptoms and maybe looking elsewhere for treating all the other symptoms that we know reflect the underlying biology and then pathophysiology of these neurochemical pathways.
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting that if we go back even 15 years, we really had no medications to treat non-motor that were FDA approved.
I was in high school. I don't remember that.
But, you know, the last few years, things are changing. And I think that's where the interest in non-motor has come back, that people are paying attention to it. There are new medications that are coming up to specifically target and treat these non-motor symptoms. You know, I'm using them. We all are using them. But do you feel we are there yet? And we can go over and list some of these non-motor treatments that are FDA approved in Parkinson's disease. Jennifer?
Well, we certainly have come along in the field, and that is very exciting. And it's quite an exciting time in neuroscience research and therapeutic development. So I'm also hopeful we'll start to see more and more of these therapies, particularly for non-motor symptoms. But as you mentioned, they've historically lagged markedly behind some of the motor symptoms, albeit important to treat tremor and dyskinesia and motor complications, certainly. But right now we only have in the United States, as you know, two FDA-approved medications, rivastigmine for Parkinson's dementia and pimavanserin for Parkinson's psychosis. So there's clearly room to grow in that. But with that said, there are also a number of medications that are not necessarily specifically approved for Parkinson's, but that have either been studied in the general population or in some cases Parkinson's cohorts that demonstrate efficacy and safety. And just for one example, thinking about antidepressants, knowing that in the general population and in Parkinson's, that SSRIs and SNRIs are generally well tolerated and helpful at improving depression symptoms with, you know, well-established safety profiles.
So it's interesting. So in the neuropsychiatric realm, there's actually two FDA-approved indications for Parkinson's disease dementia and Parkinson's disease psychosis. And you point out the antidepressants and the anti-anxiety medicines as well. In the sleep realm, we have clonazepam, perhaps, for REM sleep behavior disorder, not specifically indicated, but can be used. And then the autonomic realm, we have two medications for Parkinson's, neurogenic orthostatic hypertension, as well as the two botulinum toxins that have indications for treating chronic sialorrhea in patients with Parkinson's disease as well. So we're really getting somewhere more than we were, because for about the decade or more, we only had rivastigmine as a specific, and now we have a number of medications. That's a lot of medications to put patients on. How do you decide what are we going to treat? And do you prioritize neuropsychiatric over autonomic, over sensory, or do we have to sort of just see what's affecting our patients the most?
So I think there are a couple different angles to that question in terms of prioritization. So, you know, one is the current issue at hand, whether that's motor or a specific non-motor symptom. The other is safety and how someone's doing. So knowing that some of these symptoms, whether it's cognitive impairment or dementia or psychosis, mood, even can affect things like driving and work and other aspects of everyday life that put someone at potential risk or put their family at risk. And similarly, thinking about orthostatic hypotension. So I think with that, there's often a safety element as well to prevent syncopal episodes or presyncopal episodes that can lead to cognitive changes or lead to falls and hip fractures and other aspects. So I think there's always that give and take of what is the priority in that moment and then what are the next priorities to be looked at.
So, you know, one of the challenges with the newer medication has been a lot of physicians out there are still using the older medications. Maybe they are more comfortable with them, whatever reason it might be. For example, drooling. You know, I have patients who have dementia, and people are using anticholinergics for them, where we have a very effective botulinum toxin injections that would not cause any side effects of worsening of dementia. But if you look at these FDA medicines, whether it is pimavanserin, whether it's rigvastigmine, whether, like I said, botulinum toxin injections, whether it's droxidopa, all of them have been shown to be effective. So why do you feel that a lot of physicians are using the FDA-approved medication as their second choice rather than their first choice?
Well, I think there's a great role for education and awareness. So, you know, telling people about the symptoms and available treatments, and hopefully this program accomplishes that as well. And I think as movement disorders neurologists, in many ways, we are ambassadors to the field to help educate general neurologists, geriatricians, psychiatrists, primary care, et cetera, about some of those nuances and some of those elements of medicines that are actually harmful to our patients with Parkinson's. So avoiding dopamine blocking antipsychotics for one, very important message, but still one that even knowing that we have pimavanserin, quetiapine, and clozapine, is still a message that needs to be heard in both outpatient and inpatient acute settings. So dopamine blocking medicines, whether they're antipsychotics or even antiemetics, can greatly aggravate and worsen motor Parkinsonism. So that certainly is one of those messages. And what you just brought up about anticholinergics for whether it's part of the bladder medicine profile or treating sialorrhea really have the potential to aggravate issues in older adults and people with Parkinson's, whether that's confusion, hallucinations, dry mouth, sedation, cardiac issues. So it really behooves us to put them on a list that our patients shouldn't be exposed to. And knowing that, you know, injections for sialorrhea are rather, you know, can be quite effective and have a great impact on people's quality of life and can be readily done in the outpatient office setting.
Yeah, it's really so important to highlight this do no harm, right? Our patients with Parkinson's, due to that widespread synuclein degeneration, are at high risk of worsening their underlying non-motor symptoms from the disease by giving medications that block cholinergic receptors, that block adrenergic receptors and increase orthostatic hypotension, that block dopamine receptors and worsen motor symptoms. So really have to beware not to give them medicines that do harm. But let's turn now to medicines that can do good. And you pointed out that the first non-motor FDA-indicated drug was rivastigmine for Parkinson's dementia. And some surveys suggest that most people with Parkinson's disease will develop cognitive impairment during the course of their disease. Some place it very high, 75% or greater, others lower. How do you decide how often to monitor patients for cognitive impairment, and how do you monitor them, and when do you decide to treat? And what do you choose as first line? Do you choose rivastigmine because it has that evidence base from that ESPRESS study, or do you does it not matter whether we choose this or that drug? What do you think, Jennifer? It's a lot there.
Yeah. In terms of monitoring or assessing for dementia, I'll start there. I am a big proponent of establishing a baseline for someone's cognition, or likewise, even their mood and blood pressure and so forth early in someone's Parkinson's diagnosis. So that has merit to being part and parcel of a clinic visit to understand basic baseline of someone's cognitive function and to follow that over time to see, is it stable? Has it changed? Has it improved with interventions? Has it declined over time? And there can be a number of assessments and ways to do that, from formal detailed neuropsychological batteries, working with neuropsychologists and psychometricians, to global cognitive tests, some of which can be done in the clinic visit, to again, asking patients and having someone corroborate what their cognitive status is. But I think if someone's having cognitive trouble that's affecting multiple areas to the degree that it's impacting their day-to-day function, which would fall in line with our current definition of dementia, then it warrants that discussion of what are the treatment options and what can we do when those symptoms are present and significant. And with that, from a medication standpoint, rivastigmine as a cholinesterase inhibitor is certainly a first line and good option that was demonstrated effectiveness in a large trial. I think we could probably all argue that some of the effects in the big scheme are modest at best, but particularly if you look at rating scales and changes in clinical trials, but some amount of improvement in someone's life and being able to hold a conversation better, pay more attention, do more activities without having side effects can be very worthwhile and important. So rivastigmine, being that it's FDA approved, maybe a first line of choice. It comes in both, a pill form and a patch form, which can often be helpful if someone has gastrointestinal symptoms or diarrhea from it. The patch form often can be helpful. And if someone's taking a lot of pills, perhaps the transdermal patch alleviates, one pill that someone might need to take. So I think there are options. I think one needs to reconcile and sometimes balance other issues. So if you have someone who has dementia and orthostatic hypotension, one may need to be cautious of the cholinesterase inhibitors effects on heart rate with slowing and lowering blood pressure. But I think you might agree too that since most of our patients have constipation, the looser GI symptoms, which can occur, often tend to be a little bit less bothersome, but might actually help that constipation. And similarly, I think as going back to our non-medication discussion, it's important to consider other aspects. So driving, safety, work, advanced care planning, and really the psychosocial impacts of dementia in the course of Parkinson's.
Mm-hmm. Raj, we've often talked about establishing a baseline, and it's so great to hear Jennifer echo some of our conversations. Because if you don't have a baseline, it's really hard to make judgments later, right, especially as people age. How do you approach this establishing a baseline? What do you do in your clinics in a new patient evaluation to record baseline characteristics?
So what we do personally in the clinic is every new patient we evaluate, we do a MoCA.
Mm-hmm.
It's a straightforward, simple, validated screening tool that we have. If for no other reason, at least we have a number that we can track. And often some of our patients are like, oh, I'm only 50 years old. I'm fully functional. I don't understand why you're having me do this test. But you don't know. Maybe 2 years from now, that patient may be struggling. Maybe 2 years from now, the same patient might be very depressed and is going to also struggle with the cognition. So for us, that's the baseline we use. Ideally, we would like to at least repeat it once a year in our patients, but often it's not practically possible. So at least we try to do it every 2-3 years. If a patient is having cognitive issues, then we definitely do it once a year. But, Jennifer brought up an important question using rivastigmine and its modest benefits. But the other thing, I also like to use it in people who are on pimavecerin, because there is some data using pimavecerin with the cholinesterase inhibitors gives a little bit better improvement than by itself. So that's another reason I personally at times add on.
Jennifer suggests that rivastigmine is a first-line agent. What are your thoughts on that compared to other cholinesterase inhibitors? Do you think they're interchangeable? Do you elevate rivastigmine as first line over the other ones?
So like I mentioned earlier, you know, let's look at it, what is FDA approved first, because we have a lot more data about those drugs because they have done larger trials, at least in the disease state. Donepezil is the other one. If my patient cannot tolerate rivastigmine, yes, I may use donepezil. But if I'm going to use antipsychotics in the future, having donepezil on board, there could be potentially QTC prolongation, adding donepezil with another antipsychotic. So that's my other reason why I may use more rivastigmine versus the other one. So if you look at it being interchangeable, yes, it is, if my patient cannot tolerate rivastigmine, for example. But if they can tolerate it, then I would go first with the approved one, which is rivastigmine.
Jennifer, where does galantamine and memantine come into play? There's some recent article, a meta-analysis suggesting galantamine may be underused and may have more robust benefits than we've recognized in individual trials. Do you think that rivastigmine's first line? What would be second line? Or does it matter?
Mm-hmm. And I think some of those choices, as we mentioned, you know, are governed a bit by the large data that has come out of not only the rivastigmine trial leading to FDA approval, but the large donepezil trial. We just have more data, if you will. So galantamine, also a cholinesterase inhibitor, has been studied in Parkinson's dementia, but in a smaller number of patients. So probably about a tenth of the size of the other trials, but also for a long duration of about 6 months. And so we have less data on that, but I will say that's where some of the art complements the science. So on a clinic day-to-day basis, I would agree that if someone had side effects with one or didn't want to take something twice a day or needed to try to change one, they're a little bit different each chemically. So there can be a plausible reason to try a different one, meaning to try donepezil if someone didn't respond to rivastigmine or galantamine and so forth. I think memantine's been a little bit mixed, not only in the clinical trial, but in anecdotal experience with using it. There's literature in the Alzheimer's world as a complement to the cholinesterase inhibitors. So perhaps if we see patients who might have more memory deficits or hypothesized co-pathologies, there might be a role for that combination approach. But there are some reports of it worsening confusion. And so I'm always sensitive to that in the clinic. Again, going back to our do no harm comment earlier.
Right. So, you know, we've talked about today that clonazepam may be the first line treatment of choice for REM sleep behavior disorder. You pointed out that for sialorrhea, first line therapies are probably the incobotulinum toxin type A and rhemobotulinum toxin type B. We mentioned droxidopa, which is probably first line and FDA indicated for neurogenic orthostatic hypotension, and now is freely available at a lower cost generically from Mark Cuban's mail order pharmacy, so that can be gotten. But how about Parkinson's psychosis? There's been a lot of controversy about what's first line treatment for Parkinson's disease psychosis based on FDA indicated medications, but off-label use of other antipsychotics. You've written a lot about this, Raj, as well as Jennifer. Well, what are you thinking?
Yeah, and I don't want to keep repeating myself, but pimavanserin is FDA approved. It has been studied. It has shown to be effective. My personal clinical use is that it really can be a life changer in some of my patients. And like you mentioned earlier, it is specific towards 5-HT2A receptors. We are not affecting their dopamine. We are not affecting their adrenergic. We are not affecting the histamine. So as far as the side effects are concerned, it has much fewer side effects. Having said that, every patient does not respond to every drug they take. And I think that's an important thing to remember. We don't have head-to-head studies with the older medication, so we are never going to say this is better than the other. But let's start with the drug that's FDA approved, that is proven efficacy, proven safety. That's where I go and look at it.
Jennifer, you agree?
I think those are really valid and great points and ways to start. Knowing, as I said, there's that mix of art and science, right, and experience. I think sometimes we do need to look beyond pimavanserin and what's FDA approved. But I always think that's a great place to start, knowing we have the data and the trials that are randomized and controlled to support that. But, you know, I think we do see a number of people being treated with quetiapine, even though all the randomized controlled trials have never borne it out in terms of effect on psychosis scales, but it has not worsened motor Parkinsonian symptoms and may have some effect on sleep and anxiety. But again, being mindful of sedation and low blood pressure. The other medicine, clozapine, which you brought up, you know, has had positive effects in several double-blind placebo-controlled trials and can be effective and not worsen motor symptoms and treat the psychosis, but requires blood count monitoring. And that certainly can be done, and often in specialty centers that can be done, a little bit like your warfarin clinic and working with the pharmacy. But for many practitioners, that's often a challenge and barrier, again, being checked and monitored to prevent the or catch the idiosyncratic agranulocytosis.
Yeah, tricky. So and we should point out that all other antipsychotics beyond those three should not be used in Parkinson's disease because of the dopamine blockade and worsening of motor symptoms. So some new things, there's some research being done with some of the motor drugs, estradefillin and safinamide, trying to help non-motor symptoms. There's ongoing trials in Parkinson's dementia and mild cognitive impairment in Parkinson's disease, the SAGE drug and other drugs. We have some wearables and some new agents being looked at in Parkinson's psychosis. Before we close, anything you're particularly excited about, Jennifer, that is coming down the pike for non-motor symptoms? Should keep our eyes on.
It's an exciting time in neuroscience and our understanding of the neurobiology. And going back to a point you made very, very much earlier in the program, thinking about that non-dopaminergic system and thinking about it in new ways. So whether that's related to adenosine A2A antagonists or NMDA modulators. I think there's a lot of interesting potential in looking at new drugs and perhaps even repurposing some other drugs that might have a role in cognition, Ambroxol for one example. I think another exciting time for us is looking at the use of technology. And you mentioned wearables, which unto itself is a really broad topic and program already. So thinking about, you know, what can we do with our smartphones and apps or, sensors that we wear that have actigraphy or accelerometry to collect data on how we move or how we sleep, how we respond to different treatments, have real potential that is just waiting to be harnessed in the right way. So I think there's a lot of opportunity for these agents to have early detection of symptoms, to monitor in between visits, and to look at responses to interventions.
Raj, we spoke about a lot of things today, a lot of important things. Any closing advice you have for the people listening and to who are taking care of people with Parkinson's and managing non-motor symptoms?
Yeah, I think the first thing is being aware of it. Remembering to check with our patients at every visit, use a simple screening tool, and keep in mind that we are having more and more medications available to treat some of these non-motor symptoms where it not only affects the patient, but also their caregivers.
That's great. Well, thank you both for this really enlightening discussion. I think it really shows how far we've come in Parkinson's disease over the past decade in understanding the underlying biology and how it impacts symptoms and causes these symptoms, but also how far we have to go in trying to get better management treatment options for our patients.
And thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
We all heard a lot from Dr. Goldman about non-motor symptoms.
That's correct.
Prodromally, at diagnosis and throughout the course of the disease, how does non-motor symptoms fit into your practice?
I mean, non-motor symptoms are a very important part of Parkinson's. You know, what we see in the clinic is just the tip of the iceberg. We are looking at how slow the patient is, how much tremor they have. And unless we go deeper and try to get it from them, how much anxiety they have, how much depression they have, how much sleep issues they have, are they beginning to have some psychosis, are they getting demented? I mean, I could go on and on as far as that is concerned. I think we as neurologists need to realize we can't send our patients to 10 different specialists, a sleep doctor, a psychiatrist, a psychologist. We need to also learn to manage some of this. Agreed, we don't have to be really good at managing everything, but most of them, as we get new treatment options, for example, pimavanserin for PD psychosis, we can help with psychosis ourselves. We can treat our patients very well. Same thing with orthostatic hypotension. You know, we have droxidopa. It does help orthostasis, does help lightheadedness. We need to be comfortable using it rather than saying, you know, yes, you have orthostasis. We are worried about supine hypertension. We need to be able to comfortably manage those things.
I think it's remarkable that roughly a decade after guidelines from the American Academy of Neurology suggested there were limited treatment options for non-motor symptoms in Parkinson's, we now have FDA-approved first-line therapies of pimavanserin for Parkinson's psychosis, droxidopa for neurogenic orthostatic hypotension in Parkinson's disease, Incobotulinum toxin A and rhemobotulinum toxin B for sialorrhea in Parkinson's disease. We have rivastigmine for Parkinson's dementia. So really a lot of progress in having treatments for non-motor symptoms.
And I think part of it is also related to we are managing motor symptoms better than we were 10 years ago. And as we better manage the motor symptoms, the non-motor has become more challenging, especially in some patients. So we have to keep that in mind. Our patients are also having a better quality of life with their motor symptoms. So when the non-motor becomes an issue, we should be right up there managing the non-motor symptoms too.
I was also struck today by the conversations you and Jennifer were having about how the non-motor symptoms really influence and impact our treatment decisions for motor symptoms. And that people who have non-motor symptoms of cognitive impairment or psychosis or orthostatic hypotension or daytime somnolence, whether it's current or in the past, impact how we choose different motor therapies. And then we heard in conversations you had with Tony DiMarcata that gene testing can influence our motor treatment strategies as well. So I think there's a lot of converging lines of evidence. I think we're moving from an evidence-based approach where we incorporate clinical trial efficacy, safety, and tolerability to a personalized medical approach where we incorporate their genes to a precision approach where we actually individualize our therapies for each individual patient by looking at their genetic status and their biological status with the new biological staging and choose the treatments that are best for each individual patient.
And I think that's where the future is going to get even more important is if a patient has certain genes, maybe we should avoid certain drugs. If a patient has a different gene, maybe those are the drugs to target. We talked about a higher degree of dementia and psychosis with GBA, or at least certain mutations. On the other hand, with Parkin, we often see more dystonia, younger patients. So again, maybe those are things we might be able to decide in the future which drug is best depending upon those things.
Yeah. And then we